Today's program has been brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning and welcome to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, Executive Vice President of the James Beard Foundation, and every Wednesday at 11 o'clock, as you know, because it's Wednesday at 11 o'clock, we have a conversation about my favorite subject, that is taste. And really, obviously, we're talking about bigger things than taste. Maybe there is nothing bigger than taste, I don't know. But we're talking about food and we're talking about society. And we're just on the heels of the James Beard Foundation Annual Food Conference, which concluded last night after 2 days of really intense and interesting and insightful conversation from all sorts of different perspectives on the theme of the paradox of appetite. And you can listen, actually, if you didn't join us by live stream or in person, you can listen to the panels and presentations at jamesbeard.org on our website. Just click on the education tab and see we've archived many of the conversations. And one of the most fascinating for everyone in the room, and one of the when anyone sees Carolyn Steele's name on an agenda for any meeting, I think they all get a little excited. And I have that level of excitement here in the studio because she is with me in Brooklyn at Roberta's, all the way from across the pond in London, England, where she calls home, where she makes home. Thank you for joining us, Carolyn. Thanks for being here.
A great pleasure. Thanks for inviting me on the program.
So you may know her from her wonderful TED Talk. But have you done more than one?
I've done a couple of TEDx's as well. But
a TED Global talk on the history of how cities feed themselves or how cities shape themselves around food over time, London in particular, from her great and fascinating book, The Hungry City, which is about a similar subject. And today I just want to talk to you a little bit about where we are right now. You've been thinking lately about food as a way to... really a window into society, I guess. And I let's just start there. Like, why food? Why now? You know, small questions like that.
The trouble is I could answer that question. It would take more than 30 minutes. And I know we don't have that. So I'll try to be more succinct than usual. But essentially, I think food is too big to see. Mm. It's absolutely everywhere. I mean, of course, we know that we all have to eat kind of 3 meals a day, in some of our cases, maybe slightly more.
Yeah, so sorry. She just called me fat on air, I think, but I'll take it.
I mean, it takes one to know one. You know, we love our food. But, you know, I think for me, the revelation came when I realized that food could not only just be something that you eat, but it's also something that sort of, you know, in a sort of very invisible but very profound way actually shapes everything about our lives, you know. Mm. So the shapes of our cities, the rhythms of our day, you know, it's all around food. And also if you look historically at society and sort of think, you know, where did we come from? Even millions of years ago, you know, our hunting and gathering ancestors, you know, when they discover the control of fire, suddenly, you know, this is the beginning of society, the control of landscape, but also sort of the hunt and cooking and gathering around, you know, the sort of the kill and sharing it out. I mean, this is the basis of everything. This is the basis of who we are. And you know, right. It's still there. It's still there. This is the extraordinary thing. Go to a barbecue.
Did you hear that, everyone? Go to a barbecue right now. Stop listening. No, take the podcast with you. Go to a barbecue. But there is a presumption, I guess, in some ways that although we organized ourselves around this very important and, I mean, completely fundamental life need of feeding ourselves, but in the receding of that need, we've lost sight of some things and some things have changed perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, I think the really fascinating thing, and I'm an architect, so I come at food from a sort of strange architectural perspective.
And you don't mean tall structures of presentation plating.
No, I mean little sort of Doric columns vanishing into the distance. Exactly. No, I mean, my original question was how you describe a city through food. And this is a particularly interesting question because as it turns out, the only way you can have a city is through agriculture, you know, because it was the discovery of agriculture and grain as a food source that allowed us to have large static settlements rather than, if you like, running around after the wild boar as it disappeared off in the forest sort of thing. So the relationship between cities and food is very profound. But as cities grew bigger, and particularly through industrialization, when, you know, the food could come from a lot further away because, you know, transport via railways and so on allowed cities to grow a lot bigger and a lot further away from their sources of food, the actual feeding of the city became invisible. So, you know, sort of living in a large city like London and New York, even 200 years ago, you would have seen animals, you know, cattle walking into the city.
As opposed to walking on the Highline Park, which was designed to bring animals into the meatpacking district originally in New York here.
Absolutely right. You know, so there's been a really profound, and I just came from Chicago, and it's extraordinary, you know, because I went there, I was so excited because I thought, you know, the Union Stockyards, you know, 17 million cattle a year, I want to see this. There's nothing there.
Oh, there's some fancy restaurants now where the stockyards once were, actually. They're pretty good, but...
Exactly. And I find this really fascinating. And so the thing is, and yet, if you think about it, food physically has to arrive in the same physical position as us three times a day. Think of the logistics involved in that.
And how perishable it is, for the most part. I mean, we've done a lot to change that, but even thinking about finding fresh milk at a gas station in the middle of nowhere is a feat like getting someone on the moon. If you think about it,
I mean, what
has to happen to make that true? Yeah. This very perishable product in the middle of nowhere produced somewhere completely far away.
Absolutely right. And it's fascinating that you mentioned milk as well, because milk is a particularly interesting foodstuff in this respect, because actually it was the first high added value food. It was called railway milk.
And wow. I didn't know that.
It was milk. I mean, basically, because if you think about the difficulty of bringing dairy milk fresh into a city, you know, all cities were surrounded by dairies. Mm-hmm. But literally, by the time the milk had sort of made it in on the back of some sort of milkmaid, you know, swishing her pails around, it was kind of off by the time it got to you. So nobody drank milk. And it actually was a sort of a food associated with sort of young babies and sick people, and nobody else went near it. And then with the railways, it became possible to, you know, milk the cow at 3 a.m. somewhere out in the countryside and then bring it in on the train. In fact, Sainsbury's, which is one of our major supermarkets in the UK, it made its early profits through railway milk, which people would pay a ridiculous amount for, because it's like, wow, this fresh food, fresh from the countryside. And that is actually how, you know, milk with cereal, if you think about it, what we think of as a normal breakfast now, that's when it began to evolve.
This is a complete non sequitur in some ways, but I was so surprised to learn that Nicolas, the wine shop of Paris that's on every corner, began delivering wine every day. And I thought that was such an interesting cultural thing. They had little brown trucks that would take wine the way we had milk trucks. They got their wine.
Bring it back.
Yeah, no joke. You know, leave it to the French. That's why they live longer or whatever, you know.
Apparently.
Right. Anyway.
Well, no, how fascinating. And I think, you know, this is another really interesting issue, is that, you know, the sort of the idea that going to a supermarket to buy your food is convenient always strikes me as really weird. Again, wind the clock back 200 years. Basically, food came to you.
Right.
It came to your door. You know,
that 1900 show that was on NPR, where on PBS, where the family, it was a British show, lived like they were.
Oh, yes.
I forget what it was called.
Yeah,
it was
something
about it. But the food came. Anyway,
yeah.
I remember the fresh fruit arrived
in
the basket as it would have then.
Exactly. I mean, that's convenience.
Fascinating. I don't even know where to go. Whenever I talk to you, I never know where to go because I want to go everywhere. Maybe it's the spatial architectural thing. Food also didn't just... a surplus of food didn't just allow for a physical environment, but I've heard told that it also led to the evolution of the marketplace, the economy, that a surplus of food in the Renaissance in Italy brought people to the city to sell food, created an exchange, you know, that was outside the feudal system and supporting the community. And there too, in that way, through the economy, food has had a tremendous impact on our environments and on our society, I think, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, if society evolved originally around food and then trade evolved also largely around food, not exclusively, obviously, but it was a sort of always a very, very valuable commodity. And then you have, I mean, as you say, I mean, in Venice, for instance, you know, the sort of huge amounts of produce coming in. And then you start to get the sort of, I mean, the golden age in Venice or in Amsterdam was all around bringing very valuable stuff in, spices and so on, and then selling it on. In the case of Amsterdam, it's grain. And of course, it's these cities that evolve of advanced economic, you know, banking, lending, you know, government debt, and all of this evolves around needing to sort of negotiate around this huge value passing through and what you do with it. So that's absolutely true. And of course, now today, the modern equivalent is that we have commodities trading, you know, in futures on food. And this is increasing the volatility in price. I mean, you know, probably the fundamental thing to remember is that, you know, food is inherently the most valuable thing in society. And if we have this idea of cheap food, which in my view shouldn't exist and indeed does not exist, you have a sort of skewed value system. So if you sort of remember how important food is and internalize its cost, then a lot of things would be done very differently.
How do you do that? I know that's an impossible question.
Well, I mean, in a way, you know, I would say that sort of if somebody is producing food organically, they're probably, you know, the value of the food that they're producing is true value. In other words, you know, a huge amount of care, love, attention, hours, you know, and you know, everyone's kind of being nice to everyone and every animal and every landscape,
well,
you know.
I could hear the birds tweeting, actually, as you talk, yes.
Well, Twitter isn't just for kind of iPods. But, you know, I think what's interesting is that people think of organic food as expensive because they compare it to non-food, which has been created, this hideous kind of, you know, I don't want to name names because we'll get sued, but you know, sort of.
This is Internet Heritage Radio. You can say whatever you want to do.
We know, sort of whereof we speak. You know, sort of cheap food that I mean, it always strikes me as incredible. And we had this sort of horse meat scandal in Europe you might have heard of.
Yes, of course.
And people kind of go, my God, I've got horse in my beef burger. And you think, well, what do you think was in it? You know, you're paying sort of 50 cents
for nothing, right?
Yeah. I mean, what do you expect?
Well, as you say, the words cheap food, I feel like one of the ways to change the system is to make that. Have a disgust reaction to that phrase, cheap food.
Yeah.
In some ways, cheap sushi gives that to me already.
Yeah.
There's nothing less appealing to me than the words cheap sushi together.
Yeah.
Which isn't to say I think sushi should remain rarefied for rich people. It's just like if you're going to eat it, you should know that it comes from a good source.
Yeah, but no, exactly.
Similarly, cheap food ought to revile us.
Exactly right. I mean, you know, sort of if you sort of think, you know, what it takes to I mean, meat, I think, is the most interesting example of this because we're talking about animals here. We're talking about, you know, I happen to believe that it's okay to have. Animals in the food system as long as you treat them well. They need to have a good life and a good death just like we do. And it is possible.
And in some ways they are part of the system. One of the revelations last year at our food conference, Wendell Berry was one of our honored guest speakers and his sense of agricultural ecology is dependent on animals. It isn't not unified, not everything isn't put in the value of that animal, but part of the ecosystem of the farm, of agricultural life, involves animals, period.
Oh, totally. I mean, you know, think about the kind of we're talking about sort of circular systems here, and we're part of it. Now, I mean, men, sort of men and women, mankind, womankind,
personhood, whatever,
have evolved, you know, sort of through history with pigs and chickens. Why is this? Well, right. I mean, A, they're fantastic to eat. B, they're great to have around the house. I mean, pigs are more intelligent than dogs, and they're great company. And B, they're omnivores like us.
Right.
So they can eat our food scraps, and then we can eat them. I mean, you know, this is the way it goes. And it's a beautiful relationship, right? I mean, you had an amazing recording in the conference yesterday. You know, the final morning was sweet.
Right. Breakfast, which was the pig in the field.
Which was the pig in the field. And, you know, I mean, also, I mean, if you just think about ecology, I mean, bison roaming around the Midwest, stamping down the grass with their hooves and therefore keeping it compact, keeping the soil compact, you know, nibbling the grass, keeping it, you know, sort of nice and strong, and then pooing on it and fertilizing it. I mean, this is a beautiful ecosystem. And that you know, you can eat the odd bison and you can keep that going. And I mean, in places like Australia now, where they sort of ditched all of that, a bit like the USA, put in monoculture, which basically doesn't nurture the soil, and the soil blows away if there's a drought and so on, they're bringing back grazing animals in order to restore grassland, you know. So animals have got an incredibly powerful and important part to play in, you know, the biodiversity of the world in which we kind of, you know, both exist and also
consume. Of course. And it's that breaking of the circle which leads us to some of the trouble that we're in some way, that opening up of the ecology or emphasizing any one piece of it that throws the rest of it out. For us, we didn't have the horse meat scandal here, although we were very proud, of course, as it was unraveling. I learned later that apparently there's a 747 full of horses every week that flies from Calgary to Europe somewhere, and something happens to them. They end up in the hamburgers at IKEA. But we had our pink slime moment where they grind up all the bits and bleach it and then reflavor it and add it to the hamburgers that will only let people pay 49 cents a pound in schools for, and then we're surprised that they aren't meat.
That's right.
I mean, what do we do? It seems so obvious when you know just a little about the connections that our decisions make, but we're so willfully ignorant of them, I think.
Well, there are several things to say about this. I mean, first of all, I mean, you know, food has become invisible. Mm. You know, as I was saying at the beginning, you know, food, animals used to walk through the streets and you saw your food arriving. Now it just kind of comes in the middle of the night in some refrigerated lorry.
And we don't want to know anything about
it. We don't want to know. This is really, really interesting. If you trace the history of squeamishness, it comes with the railways. So when people... No, I mean, this is fascinating.
I love it. No, yeah. That's why I'm laughing.
You laugh when you're interested. interesting. But, you know, when the railways come, it becomes possible to, for the first time, to not know where your food comes from. And therefore, immediately people go to that place of, I don't want to know. And of course, if you think historically, again, about the status of food, I mean, it's so profound that, you know, to eat at a table is a high status thing to do. That means somebody cooked your food, somebody produced it, and somebody's going to take it away again. All of those people are low status. You know, so there's a kind of status curve about eating. Now, what we have now is a situation where most people, in terms of historical precedent, we all eat like kings. Mm-hmm. You know, because we don't have to think about who made our food, who cooked our food, or where the waste is going. And this is, but you can't have a society full of kings.
Right.
You know, so this is why it's been able to evolve in this way. People very gladly will go to a situation where they don't have to think about food, because it's inbuilt into us that this is a high status position to be in. What's interesting now, for the first time in history, is you've got, you know, a situation where it's cool to grow your own, it's cool to cook your own.
Right.
This has never happened before.
I'm going to stop you there, because that's exactly where I wanted to go, but we need to take a quick break. You're listening to Taste Matters. It's Mitchell Davis, your host, and I'm talking with Carolyn Steele about our hungry city, our hungry society, and our hungry lives.
The following is an actor reading an actual customer email from Heritage Foods USA.
My family and I enjoyed the Heritage turkey. It was far superior to the regular mass-produced turkeys in terms of flavor and texture. Absolutely delicious and worth the difference in price. We will never go back to the regular turkeys. It made our holidays more enjoyable. Thank you, Heritage Foods USA.
Heritage Foods USA hopes you had a great holiday season. For more specials on pork, beef, and other meats, visit www.heritagefoodsusa.com.
Oh, won't you save all your cherry jam just for me, girl? Please don't give none away. Let it get sweeter by the day. Oh, won't you save it, baby? Please save it. Come on and save it all for me.
Welcome back to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis. I'm talking with Carolyn Steele. Normally, I would give out our phone number and our email address, but we don't have time for that. We don't have time for your questions. We have too many things to say, so you're just going to have to hold it. If you want to reach us while you're listening to the podcast, info@heritageradio.org or tweet us at Taste Matters HRN. So you just took us from this revelatory idea that DIY, cooking yourself, going to a restaurant that even just celebrates the local things, is really a new phenomenon in the history of the status of food. That in fact, exotic things, the kings, the Renaissance merchants had lemons because they didn't grow there, not because they did grow there. And it gets us in some funny place, especially now when we're trying to find value in food or impose a value system even to other cultures of food, where we think, oh no, you should just cherish the things you have in those traditional diets you have that for years you've been trying to get out of.
Yeah.
Puts us in a funny place related
to that. It does put us in a very funny place. And I mean, I think, you know, what's interesting about this is that you could say that the only time it ever becomes cool to sort of be seen growing your own or cooking your own is when you obviously don't have to.
Right.
You know.
Right. Which you see today, too. I mean, how many billionaires have I met in the last 5 years who are called themselves farmers?
Yeah.
Because they can.
Well, there was this amazing book a few years ago called The $64 Tomato, written by a kind of, you know, U.S. Banker.
Actually, I think it was called The $64 Tomato, but whatever. That was the American edition.
Indeed. Well, you say tomato. Indeed. But, you know, and it is fascinating because, I mean, the reason I love to talk about history so much is that, you know, part of what it tells you is that everything changes with food and yet everything stays the same. And one of the most incredible examples for me about sort of understanding where we are now is looking at ancient Rome, which is, you know, de facto a society where, you know, excess and kind of, you know, sort of basically the whole of the empire sort of piling food into one tiny city sort of got to such an extreme that the various classes started to struggle to differentiate themselves from one another. I mean, Trimalchio's Feast, mm-hmm. this amazing description of a parvenu, you know, a kind of new arrival on the block, trying to prove that he was really cool by serving, you know, a kind of roast boar, sort of stuffed with, you know, pastry piglets and sort of, you know, the arrival of this thing with kind of huntsmen and dogs running around the dining room, all this kind of stuff. And of course, the whole point of this was that he was trying to emulate what the emperors were doing, but right. actually revealing how sort of coarse he was. Because in fact, you know, the really cool thing to do would have been to have been quite kind of parsimonious with
right.
food at that point.
To eat the gruel or the grain ration.
Eat the gruel. Right. In fact, there was a book written about various Roman emperors who sort of, you know, stated that they were sort of, they'd only nibble on a lettuce leaf and they were kind of vegetarian in order to distinguish themselves from the vast majority of people who were still doing the big feasting thing. So there's always going to be a sort of an attempt to separate. I mean, look at Hollywood now. You know, Hollywood is all about people, you know, sort of the social X-rays or whatever it was, Tom Wolfe.
Right.
You know, they just look like they don't eat. They kind of eat, you know.
Although,
sort of
fascinatingly for me, now those social X-rays also own restaurants, write food blogs, all have cookbook lines. Like, food has become so important here as a cultural literacy medium that
but it's
celebrities
like,
who don't look like they've ever enjoyed a complete meal.
Well, Gwyneth Paltrow
yes.
cooking, please.
I know, it's crazy.
It's absurd. I like my
Even
chef
if
to
she
look.
Loves food.
Maybe she likes vomiting it out again. I don't know, but I like my chefs to look like they like food.
Right.
You know, and you know, I of course I'm not saying, you know, you have to be fat to enjoy food, but I am saying that, you know, there's a sort of food porn thing happening here where people talk endlessly about food, but are they really, you know, doing it? You know.
No, right. Well, every time I come back, I used to teach in Italy in Florence, a group of students, and I would return with this very vivid image of someone reading the Italian issue of Gourmet magazine, just to date myself because there is no longer a Gourmet magazine, reading the Italy issue sitting in the Olive Garden and having this completely disjointed experience, but feeling like it was one. I mean, that's
yes.
what they sell. That's
yeah.
what it's. That's
yeah,
what it, the
yeah.
experience is about. And at the same time, the difficulty here in America, certainly, where the land of abundance, the land of obesity, not unrelated, but also the land where one of the few things you can feel like a king about here is to have as much food, more food than any one person needs.
Do you know what's so funny is, I mean, when I used to go, because my grandmother, who was Finnish, went and lived in California, and you just reminded me, she used to take me very proudly to this restaurant called King Table.
Course,
and it was one of those as much as you can eat.
And now I say this as someone who eats too much, are trying to tell the masses not to eat so much.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
you can't have anything and you shouldn't also eat
yeah.
too much.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, it was very interesting. Again, at your conference, Claude was talking about...
Mm-hmm. Claude Fischler, the French sociologist.
Yes, yeah. indeed. Sorry, Claude Fischler.
He'll be on the show in a couple of weeks.
Okay, cool. I'm just here to plug. I mean, Mitchell sort of just handed the $20 note across the table to plug the future programs. No,
it's all about the economy. Yeah.
But he was talking about, you know, sort of growing up in a French family and basically the, you know, the sort of the fact that you sat down for 3 hours and you ate what was in front of you and you didn't speak unless you were spoken to. This is obviously mm-hmm. as a child. And, you know, just, and actually it was kind of agony, but you sort of got a lifelong understanding of food needing to take time and not eating too much and the whole order of the table.
Mm-hmm. And I thought, and the order of society. I mean, that's where people are socialized.
From.
You see that, we saw that in Italy. People become Italians in third grade when they're forced to eat a three-course meal in the public schools of Florence with their teachers appetizer, pasta, main course, and once every month they get ice cream. That's where you make Italians, to force five fifth graders to sit for 40 minutes at the table.
Right? Absolutely. Yeah. Well, I mean, there's so much literature. I mean, Erasmus talks about this. I mean, all the sociologists talk about the fact that, you know, the table is the place of civilizing. This is where we become civilized, and it's completely the case. And I mean, I often sort of, I mean, it's very interesting. Again, I use an example in my talk at your conference, but, you know, if you go back to ancient Athens, for example, you know, sort of bad behavior at table, if you think about, you know, taking too much tiramisu on top of your, you know, your little bit of bread, you know, Plato goes on about basically these people are, they are untrustworthy. If somebody's greedy at table, they must be greedy in life, and therefore don't trust them with, certainly don't trust them with your money, and don't trust them in politics either. So it was a profound connection, and it's still there. This is what I found powerful as well. I mean, if you and I went for a meal now, which I hope we do actually, and halfway through I suddenly reach across with my hand and grab your pizza and start eating it, you'd be more than upset.
Yes.
You would actually, that would completely change your view of me as a human being. It's just like, there's something fundamentally uncivilized about this woman. Why did I invite her on the show? and that's powerful.
Right. It is very powerful. Mm. Well, and again, speaks to the power of food. But one of the things that you said at your talk that I think is so important also is this isn't about food. And, and I mean, there are elements of architecture and the physical space. There are elements of the economy and the values that we place in making money and all these sorts of things, and sometimes the food world gets a little bit lost in food.
Yes.
That we make it so visible that we don't see the rest of the stuff.
I think that's really true. I mean, I always say that, you know, food is such a powerful metaphor for life that you may as well call it life. Mm. You know, and of course we eat living things in order to live. And as I say, I mean, the value of food, which is you know, if you're starving, you understand the true value of food. And, you know, I'm an architect who discovered food, as it were, as a way of talking about, you know, cities and the way we live. And I often say to food people, actually, you know, your subject is life. You're just in the heart of it, so you can't see the rest. But I mean, you know, I always say, I mean, this is my word, sitopia, which means food place, which I invented just to say, look, we live in a world, by the way, that's from the Greek word sitos for food and topos for place. We live in a world shaped by food. And therefore, food is an incredibly powerful lens for sort of seeing life through. So it's not about food, it's about life seen through the lens of food. And then everything shifts. Again, as I say, you see it's everywhere.
Right. And you see that when you, what you choose to eat is actually more than satisfying any particular hunger or need for nutrients, that it actually is representing a value system and a way of being in the world.
Shapes the landscape, shapes sort of public use of public space, shapes social, you know, loving relationships, shapes people's abilities to have jobs that are well paid. I mean, everything is in there. Waste, you know, how much we waste. I mean, in the US, half the food produced is wasted. And that's everything from sort of in households to, you know, crops lying in the ground that, you know, it is not worth the farmer's well to take out of the ground, either because the supermarkets cancel an order or because commodity prices have dipped below a certain level. You know, so this is insane. This is absolutely insane. Victor Hugo, I mean, wrote an absolute, by the way, in the middle of Les Miserables, if you've ever heard of the show, which is actually a 1,000-page long book, there's an 80-page essay on sewers and waste about 1,000 pages in.
And you're the only one who's ever gotten that far, not seen the show. You mean it was a book before it was a show? That's crazy. Anyway.
But it's absolutely brilliant. And he says, you know, waste is so much gold. And he says, you know, but you, a sewer is a cynic. You can actually judge the values of society by looking in the sewer. All is revealed in the sewer. It's just so powerful. And he was actually a great advocate for not flushing Paris's poo down the Seine, but actually saving the nutrients in the soil. There was a huge debate in the 19th century around, should we really be sort of flushing all this stuff away? Because, of course, historically, you know, human and animal sewage was saved as very, very valuable stuff and stuck on the land as manure.
And here we are in the time of recycling and reuse.
Exactly.
And I mean, that's becoming true. We're trying to flush as little of it away as we can.
Yes. And I mean, when we hit peak phosphorus in about 40 years, the most ready available source of it, MPK, you know, sort of potassium, phosphorus, and nitrogen, that what we chuck on the plants, the most ready source of it is going to be human sewage. So we're going to have to start kind of, you know, closing the loop.
I will look forward to that day, I guess. And I hope that you're there to analyze it and talk about it with us and to have, who knows, we'll have a different meaning of sitopia then. It might be, I don't know, poo-topia? What is the Greek for poo? I guess whatever, feces, whatever.
Dawn, I wish I'd done the classics.
Thank you for being with us. That was one of the fastest half hours we've ever had, as I knew it would be. It's always a pleasure to talk with you, and I hope that we'll continue that conversation and you'll be back sometime soon.
Such a pleasure. Thanks so much for having me on, Mitchell.
Next week, we will welcome a chef working actually in an interesting environment. Dan Kluger is the chef of ABC Kitchen and also ABC Cocina, and it's a restaurant that is trying to put some of the values that we're talking about here of sustainability and the value of the producers of food into and making them cool in the coolest environments, mentioning everything on the menu and trying to figure out a way to negotiate that. They've done it very successfully this far, and you'll enjoy talking with him. In the meantime, before next Wednesday, let's get out of our throne. Let's think less about being kings of, through our food, and perhaps in the next meals that you have in the next few days, think about the cultural context in which you are having them and the values that they represent, and see if you're proud about those or if maybe you might want to make some personal changes. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.